Good morning, this is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, October 16th. Let me start by repeating a statement from last week's review that I stand by even more today. Quote, "This is an incredibly dangerous stretch for global markets as the currency wars hit on all fronts and it could easily spin out of control." I also said, however, that enlightened leadership could save the day. Just ask me how confident I am that such leaders exist. In the past, I've poo-pooed strategists and traders who wasted so much time on the plight of the greenback, and I was right. In the grand scheme of things, it has mattered virtually zero because any volatility we've seen has been easily manageable. But that began to change when the euro crisis hit in the spring, and right now, as the U.S. Federal Reserve gladly talks the dollar down in an effort to juice exports, believing the potential economic gains outweigh the many risks, the rest of the world is ticked off at us, and China. While China is ticked off at everyone as well, only China is in a better position to do whatever it pleases versus the United States, which shows you how far we are falling as a nation. No doubt, America has been through some rough patches before and eventually gotten through them because of political and private sector leadership, but regarding the former, it's not as if we are electing a new president this November. We're stuck with President Obama another 2 years. So, as the world cries for leadership in resolving the currency war, which is evolving into a trade war, what do the world's leaders do? For a second time in a week, kick the can down the road to the mid-November G20 meeting in Seoul, South Korea. Reminder, as if this confab doesn't already have enough issues on its plate, there is the not-so-little issue of new North Korean leader-in-waiting Kim Jong-un, supposedly having been told to create some excitement through his agents in the field, of which North Korea has thousands in the South. I'll be so bold as to say the clashes that always accompany these gatherings will turn deadly. The Treasury Department was supposed to issue a report on China and its handling of the yuan on Friday, i.e. whether to call China a currency manipulator or not, but the administration has decided to wait until Seoul. I'm not saying this is a bad decision necessarily, it's probably the right one, but it was the International Monetary Fund at its meeting in Washington last weekend that could have shown some leadership on the topic and did nothing as well. When you look around the world, the consensus is almost universal. The global economy has slowed in the second half versus the first, and growth in 2011 will do well just to keep up pace with 2010. Growth is projected to come in around 2.5% in the U.S. for 2011, the Eurozone below 2%. One forecaster the German government uses is optimistic Germany's GDP will end 2010 up 3.5%, but then says just 2% next year. A continuation of the muddle-through environment that feels like a recession does nothing on the jobs front. Or, as PIMCO first called it, the new normal. PIMCO's Mohamed El-Erian spoke this week of policymakers losing the peace after saving the global economy from depression because they failed to understand just how wounded the financial system is. El-Erian points to governments and central banks not recognizing how strained their balance sheets are and the impact of high unemployment. Additionally, any investments being made aren't promoting real growth and hiring, while in the case of the Eurozone, their austerity programs will contribute to the putrid environment. El-Erian also addresses a favorite topic of mine from last spring during the first euro crisis. Governments will not continue to pony up as they did in the case of Greece. That was a one-shot deal. Period. I told you last week how a majority of the German people, to cite but one example, are now against the euro currency itself. But what even great strategists like El-Erian are missing when it comes to Europe is another dynamic bubbling up from the surface. Not economic nationalism, but nationalism, period. Somehow, leaders need to figure out how to get the global economy on a steady path before other deep-seated issues get a chance to take hold. But the hangover from the financial collapse is so severe and the deleveraging process still in the early innings that it's difficult finding the light at the end of the tunnel. Maybe Chile's President Piñera, Chile not being a member of the G20, could be invited to Seoul to get everyone in the room to work together. He's not just an obviously competent politician, he is a highly successful entrepreneur, the skills of which served his nation and the miners well these past few months. Alas, we're left with the prospects for a trade war. I noted how depressed I was last time by the poll numbers showing 53% of Americans now saying they don't like free trade, and economist Erwin Stelzer picked up on this figure as well for his London Times piece last Sunday. It's all about China, and while I am still optimistic about the future of my very large investment there, I'm as unhappy as the rest of you with some of the things China is doing. Stelzer writes, there's more to rising protectionist fervor. Yes, Americans believe that China's manipulating its currency, which it is, that the manipulation keeps the value of the yuan artificially low, which it does, and that the undervalued yuan contributes to a flood of imports and joblessness in America, which it does. We also know that China has no intention of changing its policy. Responding to pressure from the U.S. Congress and from the EU, China's premier Wen Jiabao said the regime will not bend because if the yuan rises, low-margin Chinese exporters will go out of business, causing social and economic turbulence. That would be a disaster for the world. More likely, as he preferred not to add, a disaster for a regime that, lacking democratic legitimacy, can survive only by delivering a better material life for the still poor Chinese masses. Stelzer continues. Still, even if China were to accede to its trading partners' demands, Americans would be unappeased. They see not only an unfair trading partner, but a nation that is using the fruits of that unfair trading system to threaten America's position in the world. It's no good calling this a new version of the old xenophobic fear of the yellow peril. This fear is well-founded. This contrast between the expanding influence of China, including militarily, now a favored trading partner of Brazil and other Latin American countries, and the diminished influence of America is not all that is on Americans' minds. They worry that China is locking up supplies of vital raw materials, from oil to food, by befriending Iran and other countries hostile to American interests. Stelzer continues, all of which means that the changes in the trade balance that might result from an appreciation of the yuan will do little to rekindle American enthusiasm for free trade. There is more to the irritation with China than the exchange rate, or even China's persistent theft of American intellectual property. There is concern that a new enemy is emerging, while, to borrow from Jack Kennedy, America's political establishment sleeps. The rest of the world is more narrowly focused on China's currency manipulation. Since its trading partners can't get China to increase the value of its currency, which is dropping in lockstep with the dollar, they've decided to reduce the value of their own currencies in a competitive round of devaluations that bode ill for world economic recovery. Japan is intervening to drive down the yen, Brazil is taking steps to lower the value of the real, and France's president, Nicolas Sarkozy, wants to put in place a new currency system that will prevent the euro from appreciating. Erwin Stelzer concludes, John Lipsky, first deputy managing director of the International Monetary Fund, said there is no currency war. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, the sole survivor of Barack Obama's original economics team, said, quote, we're not going to have a trade war, we're not going to have currency wars, close quote. Unfortunately, those estimable gentlemen are confusing their hopes with reality. The early skirmishes in those wars have already been fought. That was Erwin Stelzer, the London Times. Meanwhile, Ben Bernanke gave a speech on Friday, and while he was being careful not to say too much prior to the election, he still managed to leave little doubt the Fed is prepared to provide additional monetary stimulus on November 3rd, the day after we hit the voting booth. There would appear to be a case for further action, said Bernanke, who made it clear his other concern, aside from the dismal labor picture, is that inflation is too low, which the Core Consumer Price Index, ex food and energy, showed on Friday to be up just 0.8% year over year. The Fed would like to see it closer to 2%. The stock market actually paused after Bernanke's comments. Since he first talked of quantitative easing, round two, in August, stocks have essentially gone straight up. Now, investors are increasingly of the mind, hey, what if it doesn't work, buying another load of treasuries and mortgage securities? Then what? And what does Bernanke's continued concern say about the overall economy, given that some indicators, such as retail sales, would have you believe that activity is picking up? And what does it say about all of us that we're letting some academic manipulate our minds in such a way that he wants us all to buy stocks and not continue to reduce our debt levels? What fonts of wisdom is he really imparting on us? Personally, I like my own instincts better than Ben Bernanke's, despite his college transcript. Let's move on to the foreclosure issue. The more I read, the more I'm reminded of the problem Spain had at the height of its bubble when Brits and such were flocking to buy homes on the Costa del Sol and learned later they didn't have proper title. Or this newsletter I subscribe to titled International Living, where the stories of buying a beach house in Brazil or Uruguay always look so enticing, but my first thought is, what about the title? How can you trust even the locals that IL is recommending? But then you look at the massive fraud taking place in America, and once again you wonder, what the hell is the difference between us and them? And yes, robo-signing is fraud, folks. I got ticked off when I read a Wall Street Journal editorial that said the following, quote, "We're not aware of a single case so far of a substantive error. Out of tens of thousands of potentially affected homeowners, out of tens of thousands of potentially affected borrowers, we're still waiting for the first victim claiming that he was current on his mortgage when the bank seized the home. Even if such victims exist, the proper policy is to make them whole, not to let 100,000 other people keep homes for which they haven't paid. But that's not the point in this whole exercise. There's a reason why you hire an attorney when you buy or sell a home, as I did in January. There's a reason why you trust them to do the title search and other things. So at the end of the process, both parties are satisfied it was done legally. It's been the hallmark of America's private property rights tradition that has long set us apart from other countries, and no matter how you slice it, many of these foreclosures and sales are not technically legal, and you can't just slough it off. Some of the cases we're all reading about are unreal. And it's for good reason some of the banks saw their shares taken out to the woodshed this week, like Bank of America, which has a huge pile of foreclosures that now need to be reworked. This country can't do anything right these days, except for Dunkin' Donuts and McDonald's. The problem with the foreclosure mess, of course, is that there are two things recovery is hinged on, a stable housing market and an improving jobs picture, and neither is occurring. All of the foreclosed properties have to be re-scrutinized by the banks and then sold, and this will take months and months and years. Heck, I had no clue that the average foreclosure was taking 478 days as it is before this mess. It was 292 days in 2006. And consider this. In the second quarter, 56% of all sales in Nevada were foreclosure sales, 47% in Arizona and 43% in California. So the real estate market in these states essentially stops cold until we solve the documentation problem. One thing you'll probably see, short terms at the median home price could get a boost as buyers shy away from distressed properties, but eventually all these foreclosures will come flooding back on the market to depress prices all over again. Now, I was reading a piece by Mark DeCambre in the New York Post on some of the issues involved in the crisis, and it's easy to forget Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac guarantee nearly 90% of all mortgages originated in the U.S., and the estimated hit that the two could rack up if there was a foreclosure moratorium is another $400 billion from souring loans, on top of the $150 billion they have already lost. Lastly, a number of commentators, including Kathleen Parker and author William Cohan, reminded us this week that no one has been found criminally liable for practices that led to the financial crisis. Angelo Mozilla's case was a civil one. Cohen argues that thanks to the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, we are getting closer to hauling in the culprits. Parker calls for a special prosecutor. We need one. A few notes in the international scene. France has been hit by another series of strikes over President Sarkozy's proposed pension reform, which is to be voted on by the French Senate next week. The strike spread to the energy sector, and at one point all 12 of France's refineries were shut. As I go to post, there are legitimate fuel shortages developing, which is just great for an economy in recovery, isn't it? And strikes have been called for the UK in November to protest austerity cuts there, while there were more strikes in Greece that closed the Acropolis. Too bad the Greek government couldn't just release the Kraken. In China, it appears third quarter GDP will come in at a still strong 9 to 9.5%. This week, the government released figures for September exports, up 25% over last year, though below August 34% pace, while imports were up 24% versus 35% in August, so further evidence of a global slowdown. Housing prices in China for August were up 0.5% in the major cities, which is not exactly what the government wanted to see given its bank tightening program coupled with restrictions on second and third homes. And separately, foreign direct investment in China was up a strong 6% in September. Stocks rose for a sixth time in 7 weeks, with the Dow Jones adding 0.5% to 11,062, while the S&P 500 tacked on 0.9% and NASDAQ 2.8%, thanks to a $60, 11% rise in Google's share price on Friday following its earnings report, as well as a series of all-time highs in Apple shares, which closed the week at 314. IBM also hit a record high this week, a level not seen since July 1999. But GE's earnings report was not good, and that revenues were well below expectations, and Intel's were just so-so, given that back in August it pre-announced a disappointment. That's all for this week. I am not going to be back with you for a number of weeks. I'm going to be on a long, long trip across the Pacific and to Micronesia and Australia. But please click on Week in Review at stocksandnews.com. Take care.